You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
Nidapesks Aguanu. Hello, friends, and welcome. I'm Sherry Mitchell, coming to you from my home in the Dawnland in Bunawabskik territory, located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine, the heart of Wabanaki territory. I'm joined today by my wonderful co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Hello, Sherry. You know, it is just a big thrill to be back on the air and to be having the conversations that we love to have along with all of our listeners. And so I just want to give them a shout out and say thanks for rejoining the podcast with us after this hiatus. Today, as the wind blusters across my fragile-looking irises outside the window in all their spring glory here in Taos, New Mexico, we are going to turn our attention to Sherry's new book. Last week we looked at my new book, The Roots of Resistance. This week we're going to look at hers. And no, listeners, it's not just a little bit of ego going on. It's actually that between our books and what we write, we cover a lot of the topics and themes that we feel are the most important to look at in our lives and in our world today. And so they become a lens that helps us focus and reflect on the broader themes that we'll be exploring in the show in its new incarnation. So hang on to your hats. Sherry's book is quite a ride with a lot of topics behind it, all of which interrelate and all of which may open our eyes to a way of looking at the world that helps us move forward in a sustainable, humane, and sane way. So, Sherry, I want to start just by having you speak a little bit about the process of this book. You've been writing it for a while, and it's finally out, but what was the journey getting from the first day you thought about writing this book to today?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. I have been doing a lot of writing for most of my adult life on a number of different subjects and a number of different genres, and had not written a book on the things that were most central to the way that I live my life. And I've had the incredible honor of working with a number of Native American spiritual elders from across the United States and Canada and in Central and South America even for the last 30 years. And in that process, I've done a lot of writing for them in sharing the messages that they wanted to get out into the world in a way that allowed people to understand the message that they were attempting to send. And after years of doing that, one of the elders approached me and told me that it was now time for me to write my own story and to put that out into the world. And there was a long conversation connected to that, because we oftentimes refrain from sharing certain teachings in a written form because we understand that there's such a strong correlation to the oral traditions and the way that information is passed in relation to our understanding of vibration and frequency. And so there was a little bit of reluctance on my part initially, but the elders told me that it was my work to do that, that this was the job that I had been born to do, and that if I didn't do it, then I wouldn't be fulfilling my purpose here. And also, you know, if we don't bring forward what it is that we're meant to bring forward, then we'll end up becoming sick. And so I experienced illness after that message was given to me. And I decided that it was really time for me to listen. And so I started writing a book that I thought was going to be the book that would be published, and had been reading different portions of that in my talks in different places. And at one of those talks, someone approached me and asked if they could publish my writing. And so it seemed like a good time to really move the discussion forward into completing the work that I had been charged by the elders to complete. And the book that I had written that I thought was meant to be out there, when I finished it and submitted it to the publisher, I looked at it and said, you know, this is not the book that I want to publish. Can you please just hold back and let me redo this? So I ended up rewriting the entire book in about 90 days. And it's completely different than what I thought I was going to be writing about, but it is the book that was meant to be written for this time.
Wow. That's quite a revision process in a short amount of time. What is the crux of the shift that you felt was needed for this time?
Well, I don't know if I really thought about it consciously. I think that what happened was I had many of my own ideas about what I thought really needed to be said during this time. And in the end, what ended up happening was I just got out of the way and allowed the stories that needed to be told to come through. So I feel like I was a participant in the process of writing this book, but that there was a larger force at play in determining what ended up being published.
Wow. Well, that's a different process than maybe 90% of the nonfiction books that are out on the market, which are often ego-driven and sometimes quite superficially researched. The old pattern of I took a workshop and then I wrote a book about it seems to surface a lot in our contemporary publishing world. This is a very different sort of a ball of wax and a very different sort of a book. What can you give the listeners a basic overview of what's in the book?
Well, the book really kind of outlines the way of life and the trajectory of the path that I've taken to come to the understandings that I hold most dear. It outlines a way of life that's in harmony with the rest of creation. It looks at where we are now and how we got here, our several thousands of years of violent history that we share, so that we can understand how our minds have been influenced by that and our relationships have been formed under the guise of the illusions that that way of life has presented to us. It also looks at what our responsibilities are in relation to being here and living in this beautiful place that we are able to call home, Mother Earth. We like to say that we have a lot of rights. And we have to recognize that all of those rights are balanced with a set of corresponding responsibilities. So what are those responsibilities and how do we honor them? It also challenges us to look at our childlike dependence on some of the systems, structures, and beliefs that we have been holding individually and collectively for thousands of years again, and invites us to mature emotionally, spiritually, societally, and now it's time for us to mature and to use them in a way that helps us to create the type of world that we want to inhabit. And it also talks about prophecy and how we are now living in a time of prophecy. There are a number of prophecies at play during this time, and also asks us the question, what is our responsibility during a time of prophecy? Are we simply meant to be observers of the prophecies that are unfolding, or are we meant to be active participants in them so that we can actually create the type of world that was promised to us when the prophecies were first told?
There's a theme that keeps coming up in many parts of the book, which I've now read from cover to cover and appreciate so much, especially the last third, I think, is the part that moved me the most, and we'll get into that later. But the common theme that I keep seeing is this shift from being in the backseat of the world as it is right now to being in the front seat, although that might be a shared responsibility. It's not just you're driving the whole world. And so I see it when you wrote about rights and responsibilities, that often we want these rights handed to us, but we don't want to step up and put our hands in the muck of the world and take responsibility for the mess. I see it in the shift from the childlike dependency. And then later on in the book, you also talk about core cultural values along with four foundations for a self, governing society. All of which kind of, they require us to step up to the plate and to do the healing work of all the past and the traumas that we might be carrying so that we're prepared to actually be active players on this shared field that we are co-creating. Can you speak a little bit about those themes and about what some take-homes from that theme from your book are for people?
Well, I think that one of the things that we do very well is that we delude ourselves into thinking that the reality that we've projected is the only reality that exists. And part of that projection that we have created is this notion that someone else is going to come along and solve our problems for us. And so when we're thinking about how do we become the change that we want to see in the world, that process involves us taking an active role in the creation of the type of world that we want to inhabit. When I think about the trauma that we've experienced collectively, I think about it through the lens of my own traditional teachings. And many people have heard about these web of life teachings that are connected to the indigenous worldview and think that it simply means that we're all connected and that, you know, we everything that we do influences everyone else. And that's certainly true. You know, we live in a web of life where our actions in our own individual small spheres impact the whole of creation. However, there's a much deeper meaning to those web of life teachings that many people have not had the opportunity to learn. So when we talk about these deeper web of life teachings, what we're really talking about is what science now calls quantum entanglement. So we understand that we all come from the same seed of life. Our word for creator in my language is Kachiniwas, which is the great seed of life. And that is the larger seed of matter that when it opened and exploded, has created the entire known universe that we are a part of. And so what quantum entanglement tells us is that any matter that was once connected physically can never be disconnected spiritually or energetically. A way to understand that is to think about when people have an amputation, say their leg is amputated below the knee, their foot often still itches or they still have pain in their lower leg, even though the physical matter is absent. That's because the physical matter that once made up that leg is still energetically and spiritually connected to the individual. And it's the same when we think about these web of life connections that we have, that we are connected to that original seed of life that once held us all together in this one ball of matter. And even though that matter has been dispersed throughout the universe, we are still energetically and spiritually experiencing the same things that others are experiencing simultaneously. So there was a study that was done, I believe, in 1992 in Geneva, where they had a twin photon experiment. And this really proved out the theories that we have professed through our traditional teachings connected to that web of life understanding. And what they did was they had these two photons, they separated them. They were originally one, and to see if they would communicate with one another across distance, they separated them for 14 miles. And they would do something to stimulate or to create some type of, you know, action or change in one photon to see if the other responded. And what they found out was that not only did the other photon respond, but it responded instantaneously. There was no time lapse. And so they've been able to conduct these experiments on a larger and larger scale. And what they've determined is that that's true across the entire universe. So when we think about that in relation to trauma, what that tells us is that all of the traumatic experiences that all of our individual groups have suffered throughout time, throughout our shared history, have been experienced by all of us simultaneously. And even though we're not able to name it, even though we often don't recognize where it comes from, we're carrying the pain of that wounding within our bodies, and we're sharing in that collective experience of trauma across the globe. So you have so many people who are experiencing anxiety and depression, and some of those people are able to point to a distinct cause for what they're experiencing. Others, it's not so easy for them. They have unnamed trauma, unnamed anxiety, unexplained depression. And that's because they're picking up the experiences of the rest of creation, not only the trauma being experienced by human beings, but the trauma that's being experienced by Mother Earth is also being shared by us in a collective way across the globe. And so when we start understanding those deeper principles and how we're truly so deeply connected, far beyond any understanding that has been vocalized in the past, I think it's easier for us to understand and to take responsibility for the reality that we're inhabiting, because we are the ones who are responsible for creating it. And so that theme of taking responsibility and understanding our deeper ties to one another beyond even, you know, the physical realities of impacting our physical world and physical life, that there are deeper energetic and spiritual ties that are also impacting our ability to be able to continue to have the right to live here on Mother Earth, because we're failing to step up for the responsibilities that are associated with that bargain.
Can we name some of those responsibilities specifically and tangibly so that people have a sense of what should they be doing?
Yeah, I think that it's really important for people to recognize that they can't claim a right to life without ensuring that all other living beings within creation have that same right to life. That's not just our species alone. That's all species. You know, that's the plants, the trees, the animals, the waters, the lands, our wind, which ocean, you know, all of those things that make up our entire living system must also be given the right to live unmolested. And we can't claim a right to be free from violence ourselves if we're unwilling to claim that right, you know, take responsibility for ensuring that all others have that same right. And so when we think about the challenges that we're facing in the world, a lot of it is a lack of equity within the experiences that human beings are having. There are some who have easy access to food and shelter and medical care, and their lives are free from violence. There are others who struggle every day to find enough food to eat, to be able to have access to water, who can't afford medical care or are denied access to it from, you know, by one means or another. Their lives are not safe. They live in a state or a threat of violence on a daily basis. And we can't expect to have any of the things that we need in order to live our lives in a dignified, secure way that is just and humane unless we're willing to take responsibility for creating that reality for all. And so when I talk about the balancing of rights and responsibilities, anything that we would ask for ourselves, we need to create the environment, the society, the reality that allows for that same thing to be available to all other living beings.
That's really wonderful, the way that you are actually deepening that golden rule concept of do unto others as you would have done unto you, and saying, if you would like to enjoy this, then you have a responsibility to make sure everyone can enjoy this. There's a parallel kind of thing that you do in the back of the book that's been very interesting to me about the core cultural values. And the reason that it comes up for me when I talk about rights and responsibilities is that in U.S. culture, we often assume rights, and it's very important to us, but we don't actually have much thought about responsibilities. And so there's a real cultural difference in there. And in the latter part of your book, you've identified other cultural differences between the dominant culture of the United States, or the westernized world, much of this applies, and the traditional teachings and cultural values that come out of your indigenous background. Would you speak about some of those and why understanding these differences might be really important for all of us at this time?
Well, yeah, there's a whole list of values that I talk about in the book. And one of them at the very top of the list is this distinction between communal living and individual living. And so when we think about what the ideal has become, oftentimes through all of our doctrine and dogma, we've been led to believe that this, going off on the mountain by ourselves individually is the golden standard. This Western idea of rugged individualism that leads us to believe that our ascent to the top at any cost is the true measure of success. That's completely different from indigenous worldview, where the measure of success is based on the well-being of the whole, the well-being of the entire community. And so the communal versus individualized value structures are completely different. When we think about the way that our humanoid species has been able to survive in the world, it was not by going off on our own. We did not go off on our own and face woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers. We actually were able to survive when other humanoid species were not able to survive because we learned to live in community with one another and to look out for and care for one another. We've lost sight of that in the way that we live within the modern society. And so we also use a lot more resources and waste a lot more resources when we are living individual lives. And so when we think about the way that we have come to live and the way that led to our survival, they're very different. And so the communal sense of value, living in community, being willing to look out for and help one another, sharing resources so that nothing gets wasted, is, you know, a way of being in the world that not only sounds nice, but it's actually practical, and it helps us to be able to live in a much more sustainable way with a much smaller imprint. Even though we're living together collectively, we're using a lot less than if we were living individualized, siloed lives. Another is the distinction between elders and youth, where in the mainstream society, youth and beauty is idolized. It doesn't matter how those individuals are living their lives. It doesn't matter what they have to offer in real tangible or ways connected to wisdom. All that matters is that they're young and that they're pretty and that they show this exuberance towards whatever type of lifestyle they're living. In our culture, in my cultural traditions, we actually look at the elders as the symbols of beauty and wisdom and guidance, that those are the ones who we hold up high. Those are the ones that we look at and look to in order to guide our lives. And so when we have young people who haven't the experience necessary to provide them with a deeper wisdom, who are being held up as the models, our whole society becomes much more immature. And what we need to really think about is, how do we get back to a place where we are honoring, listening to, and being guided by the wise elders in our community, so that our entire society can begin to mature again. We've kind of had this regression where we're not maturing because we're not listening for and looking to those wisdom keepers anymore within the larger society. And so, you know, there are a whole number of core cultural values that I talk about in the book that are connected to our way of life currently, and how it is actually diminishing our ability to be able to maintain our right to live here on Mother Earth, and how, you know, this other set of values that has been held within the cultural continuity of some of the indigenous traditions actually guides us back toward a way of life that is in harmony with our survival.
One of the things that I love about your work, and particularly your writing, is your ability to bridge concepts and cultures and ideas and areas of thought that are often very much separated, in the dominant culture anyway, like science and spirituality, for example, or the connection of the personal and the political, that you can have both a spiritual and personal practice and show up in movements. And one of the places that I see you doing this work in is around the divine feminine and divine masculine, that these have been severed and separated coming out of the Christian or the colonized perspective. And you have done quite a bit of work in the book and in your teachings on getting people to understand why those things need to be rebalanced and held in relationship to and with one another. Would you like to speak a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think that one of the things that is evident to a lot of people is that the way that we've been living has been imbalanced and leaning toward a very aggressive external way of being in relation to the rest of life. And part of our process, you know, we have these overarching themes of conscious evolution that are unfolding on a much longer arc than the individual experiences that we're having in regard to our own spiritual growth. So when we think about understanding that we need to, balance the intuitive, heart-based wisdom within us with our external action, is easy for people to understand that we there is characteristics with feminine energy and masculine energy. One of the teachings that we have in our community, and some of our two-spirit members in our community really are able to speak eloquently about this, is this understanding that those individuals who have really balanced and can embody one or the other are really individuals that we need to look up to help guide our pathway. And so what we're admiring and honoring within them is their ability to be able to balance the masculine and feminine energies within them and to embody either of them individually, and to also merge them collectively into a beautiful expression of wholeness.
I want to get back to that after we take a quick break for a station ID.
When we look at the world around us, if the feminine is the intuitive heart-based wisdom and the masculine as the external action out in the world, we can see that the separation between the feminine and the masculine, the, you know, kind of subjugation of the feminine and the promotion of the masculine has led to the imbalance in our world where we have a lot of external, very aggressive, action-oriented energy that's spiraled through our societies for thousands of years that has not taken into consideration the sacredness of life and has certainly not put the sacredness of life at the top of its value structure. And so when we think about the long arc of conscious evolution for the entire species, we've been going through what appears to be a very slow progression through that understanding of the need to not have one or the other overemphasized. And so if we were only acting, utilizing our feminine energy, and these energies are not gender specific, they're energetic characteristics. If we were acting using only our feminine energy, then we would sit in contemplation and we would, you know, come up with a lot of beautiful creative ideas that are heart-based and connected to divine wisdom, but we would never act upon them. And when we're only operating with our masculine energy, we're just acting out in the world without the benefit of guidance from the divine wisdom and heart-based knowledge that in that creativity, problem solving that sustains life aspects of the feminine. And so in order for us to become balanced as a society, what we need to do is to balance those energies not only within ourselves, but within the structures of our society so that the decisions that are being made are being guided by heart-based, intuitive, divine wisdom that is in support of, protection of, nurturing of, the sacredness of life. And so, you know, when we look at that on the larger scale, we see that we're all immersed in this process, individually, collectively, socially, and in every other way. We're immersed in this process of trying to balance the masculine and the feminine within us. And that the key to our survival is really connected to our ability to be able to stop separating the two, stop separating our hearts and minds, stop separating our actions from the intuitive wisdom that we have, the cultural values that we carry, and begin operating as fully embodied, well-balanced human beings. So when I think about the masculine and feminine, I think about all of those aspects and how they show up every day in everything that we do.
I can see where the challenge lies in terms of the doing the work personally, but also doing it collectively. And another word for that is socially, politically, culturally. And one of the things that I appreciate about your book is the ways that it doesn't just narrow down into a personal self-help book. It really always has an eye on that connection between the personal and the political. Let's say, the purposes of a thought experiment, that everybody's working on this balancing act of divine feminine, divine masculine. They're like learning some of these core cultural values. What are some ways in which they can move into action from these perspectives? You bring up conquest activism in the book, and maybe that's a good place to start in terms of critiquing how we're doing activism now, while also having an opportunity to propose a different way.
Well, I mean, there's not a simple formulaic way to approach this because, you know, we're all working together and we're working on unfolding these concepts and the awareness of the larger state of our being in relation to the rest of life on an individual basis. And the way that we're doing that has to be organic. You know, it can't be linear or formulaic. And so the key to beginning this process, I think, is to really decolonize the way that we are viewing the world. We have to be willing to really look hard at the things that we have come to believe are true. We have to question ourselves about how we came to believe that those things were true. what were the sources of information that informed our decision making in relation to those ideas, concepts, ways of being, and whether or not those ideas, concepts, and ways of being are aligned with the deeper truth that we know about our interconnectedness and our interrelatedness. Are they really aligned with our survival as a species? Are they aligned with the sacredness of life? Or are our decisions being guided by these principles that have arisen and become so dominant under the patriarchy that minimize everything to a consumptive equation? So when we think about how we assign value in the world, we often assign value in relation to monetary terms. So even when somebody is single, we say that they're on the market. And so we've commodified, commercialized, and made saleable all of the aspects of our being. We break ourselves into fragmented, saleable parts. And so when we think about how we assign value in the world, one of the key steps of decolonizing our minds is shifting our value structure away from those patriarchal and colonial ideologies that are associated with the commodification of our being. And we have to start placing the value of life, the sacredness of life, at the top of our valuation structure. So if we're thinking about how are we going to engage life, how are we going to treat the environment, how are we going to have relationships with other human beings, how are we going to engage our activism, we have to think about it in relation to that colonial structure and say, you know, am I trying to dominate, oppress, or suppress the other? Or am I trying to create understanding and kinship? Am I attempting to eliminate, or am I trying to compassionately understand? And that's a big stretch for a lot of people because there is so much harm that is being done to individual human beings, to entire groups of people, the discrimination that's based on race and religion and socioeconomic status that we experience around the world is so painful and so divisive for those who are being targeted that it's hard to catch their breath. It's hard to, connect with that higher wisdom that informs us that the status quo is maintained through the repetition of these cycles of conquest that we have been participants in. And if we want to truly change the paradigm that we're living in, we have to be able to approach these things with a completely different set of values, a completely different understanding of wellness. We have to recognize that this idea of conquering or this idea of competition or winning is actually suicidal in many ways. You know, it leads to our ultimate destruction. And so how do we become more cooperative? How do we become more compassionate? How do we create more understanding in all of the things that we're doing? There is a story about individuals that I've worked with through my trauma workshops and also through the work that I do in helping people design effective movements, where we talk about specific examples. We talked about one of them in relation to your book, where there was space created by acts of loving kindness and respect for the right of the other individual to have the same thing that you were asking for. So in regard to that particular story, it was the RCMP and employees of a hydrofracking company that were coming up against a small group of tribal people. And there was a lot of conflict and there was a lot of violence. And so when the grandmothers came to the front of the line and they started informing those other individuals that they valued the sacredness of their lives and the lives of their children in the same way that they valued their own lives and the lives of their children, something shifted. There was an opening that was created that allowed them both to walk into a new space together. And so rather than being locked in opposition and in conflict and in this violent confrontation, they were able to collectively create a whole new space for them to occupy together. And that needs to be the goal of all of the things that we're doing. We need to be able to have the courage, the emotional and spiritual maturity to create those new spaces for us to occupy together in a way that allows for the protection and the acknowledgement of the sacredness of life.
Sherry, I wanted to talk a little bit in the second part of the show about the four foundations for self-governing societies, because I found them really interesting in terms of resistance struggles. Particularly indigenous struggles have come to mind, where the struggle is very much about sovereignty, of culture, of land and place, of identity, of decolonization. But it also made me think about Gandhi's struggles for self-rule, in terms of this shared understanding that if you want to not live under tyranny of another group, you need to take responsibility for certain aspects of your culture and society. And in your book, you identified four different ones, and I'm hoping you'll speak about them.
Yeah, and this isn't about self-governance. It's about being self-determined, you know, deciding who we want to be in relation to one another and to the rest of the world. And so when we look at breaking the chains of dependence that have been established under the patriarchal system, we have to be willing to take really bold steps to free ourselves from the enslavement of those systems. We have to be willing to recognize that we do not live in a post-colonial era, that the nature and the structure of colonization has shifted, but we are still being colonized. And there are four primary areas where we are being colonized and enslaved. And the four areas that I talk about in the book are water and energy and food and education. And so when we think about water and we think about food, our water is being largely controlled by corporations today. The element of water is one that we require in order to live. We couldn't live for very long without water, you know, a matter of days. And when we think about the way that water is being contaminated, when we think about the ways that water is being extracted and then sold back to populations so that they can live, the water that exists in the place that they are residing is being taken away from them and sold back. That's colonization. That's exerting dominance over a group of people and making them dependent upon you for their survival. That is the very definition of colonization.
And so just to clarify, you're not just talking about in Native communities. This is something that's happening to all of us, that those who once were the colonizers are now also the colonized.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things about colonization that people don't realize is that there's no end point to it. And so, you know, I'll come back around and talk about patterns that are put into motion, but there's no end point to colonization. Once it reaches the end of its feeding line, what it does is it reverses itself and begins to cannibalize itself. So those who were part of the original settler set who felt that they were safe within that system, they're now being cannibalized by the same system that they helped support. And so when we look at things that have happened largely to minority and fringe populations, we see that those things are leaking out into the commons now and everybody's experiencing them. Everybody on the planet is going to be impacted by the colonization of our water. And so we have companies like Nestle who are sucking water out of the ground at unprecedented rates. And the CEO of the corporation says that water is not a human right. What that company is saying to the entire world is that human beings do not have the right to life. And so we have to recognize how we're being yoked by these different systems. So where that's happening with our water, and we have a finite amount of water on the planet. And, you know, for the first time in human history, we're actually taking water out of the water table through the practice of hydrofracking, where water is being injected below the bedrock. And so, you know, we're eliminating our ability to survive by accepting the colonization of our water, by accepting the abuse and the misuse of our water. That is limiting our ability to survive on the planet. So that's one of the four pillars. In relation to food, these large-scale agricultural industrial practices, monocrop agriculture, all of these things were created under the guise of being able to feed the hungry. We have more hungry people now than we ever did when food production was localized. And so looking at the way that our food systems are controlled, there are places, many places in this country and around the world, where people are not allowed by law to grow food in their own backyard and share it with others. There was an entire organic farm in California where they had a big community dinner and they invited people in to have a meal with them, where the FDA came in and poured bleach all over their crops because they weren't allowed legally to share those crops without FDA approval. What is wrong with the world when we can't grow food and share it with our neighbors? There's something really wrong with that scenario, and that again is colonization. That is the inability of human beings to be able to determine how to live their lives in the way that is in alignment with their values. When has sharing become a crime? You know, we need to start looking at these things and understanding the impacts that they're having on our larger life.
I think that's a really great point about the food and about what a foundation that is. And I think if we look historically at colonization, but also contemporarily at colonization and the system of capitalism and consumerism, it relies upon us being enslaved to it, that we must go to the market to buy our food, that we can't get off of that system. That's what perpetuates it. And it perpetuates exploitation, perpetuates inequality, all of these things. Extraction is another thing. We have energy and education are also in those four foundations. But I'd love to take, we only have a few minutes left, but I'd love to talk about the education pillar just a little bit. Because I feel like, you know, we get it, food, water, energy, basic human rights. What is it about education that makes that so crucial to those four foundations?
Well, we have, you know, really become victims of a corporatized educational structure. Public education was created in order to turn out capable factory workers. And when we think about the way that the educational system that began to emerge was immediately stifled and has since been diminished, we can see that our ability to be able to think critically and creatively is being stymied. Standardized testing, standardized educational programs, all of these things that are based on the ability of the individual to regurgitate information rather than to solve problems, to discover what is the right answer in relation to all of these values that we're talking about, and not just in regard to the current social status that has been established or structure that's been established. We've eliminated our ability to solve our own problems creatively. And if we want to be able to have individuals coming forward who are going to be able to help us to come up with solutions for the challenges that we're now facing, they can't be trained to think in the same ways that created the problems in the first place. Isn't that what Einstein told us? And so we have to be able to take charge of our educational systems so that our children are not simply becoming obedient cogs within the current wheel, so that they can actually challenge and look critically at the current systems to see if those systems are in aligned with the type of world that they want to inhabit going forward. We have to train our children to be able to think creatively outside of these really restrictive boxes to be able to solve the problems that we're facing in the world. And so education is a key component of that, because our educational system has really been about keeping people locked into the status quo. And if we want to change that, then we have to change our educational systems, which means we, again, have to take responsibility for the education of our children and stop leaving it to someone else and allowing them to decide what it's supposed to look like and feel like and what the results are supposed to be of that education.
That seems to be the core theme of the book and the conversation today about engaging, awakening, embodying, empowering, all shared themes and concepts about just stepping out of our dream state or our passive state or our disempowered state and really becoming fully alive and present in these times in all the dimensions of what it means to be a human being. In the very end of your book, and we are getting down to the last few minutes of the show, and I know the listeners want this to go on for days and days, but, you know, they should just get your book, Sacred Instructions, in Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change, and take the time to read through it. But I will say that the last chapter of the book is all about living in a time of prophecy. And I think that might be a good closing note to explore for a few minutes here. What does this mean, living in a time of prophecy, and what does it require of us? I mean, it's not like living in a time of non-prophecy, where we could maybe just have a white picket fence and a dog and a couple kids and, you know, a beer after work and go about our daily lives until we die. Nope, we're in a big time right now, and whether it's from the prophecy perspective or just the necessity of change, I think that puts some things on the plates of our lives that we need to step up to. What might be your perspective on this?
Well, I outline a number of different prophecies in the book, and I certainly don't have time to go into all of those. But essentially, it corresponds to a specific set of prophecies that were given to us seven generations ago. We are the seventh generation of these particular prophecy givers. And so a good example is the prophecy of Crazy Horse, which says, upon suffering beyond suffering, the Red Nation shall rise again, and it shall be a blessing for a sick world, a world filled with broken promises, selfishness, and separations, a world longing for light again. I see a time of seven generations when all the colors of mankind will gather under the sacred tree of life, and the whole earth will become one circle again. In that day, there will be those among the Lakota who will carry knowledge and understanding of unity among all living things. And the young white ones will come to those of my people and ask for this wisdom. I salute the light within your eyes where the whole universe dwells. For when you are at that center within you and I am at that place within me, we shall be as one. And so that clearly came true. That prophecy came to fruition at Standing Rock when people, young people from all over the world came to the Lakota people seeking guidance on how to stand for life in a peaceful and prayerful way, how to reconnect their way of viewing the world in relation to their connection to a thriving, healthy ecosystem, to a thriving, healthy earth. And so we also have a prophecy in our territory about the reopening of the Eastern Door, which says when the people of the earth rise up and begin standing in unison for the protection of life, they have to come back to the east, which was the first point of contact on this continent And it was there that the first blood was spilled between our people and the newcomers. And so that was the original contract signed in blood of this land. And so when the people start rising up, they have to return to that place to rewrite those sacred contracts so that we can open the possibility for us to create a new way of being in relation to one another. Because that contract that was originally written in blood is what has informed the creation and the development of this nation. And we see the amount of violence that exists here. And so we have a lot of work to do in order to show up for the things that are being outlined in these prophecies. We can't just say, oh, yeah, that, you know, that kind of looks like the time we're in. We have a responsibility to take heed of our ancestors' messages and to step into our role as being the ones who are able to create for our seventh generation a new way of being in the world that is in alignment with life.
Well, Sherry, I know that you are certainly stepping up, not just for yourself, but to encourage and inspire and help other people to take those steps forward. I also know that you're taking that prophecy and you're helping it come into fruition with your gathering of Healing the Wounds of Turtle Island in July 14th through 17th, I believe it is. 13th through 16th. And if people want to find out more about that, and if you could tell them where to find your book, because I'm sure there's many people listening at this point who want to get their hands on a copy, where can they find out about that?
The book is available at a lot of bookstores. It's certainly available online through a number of booksellers, through the publishers, North Atlantic Books, Penguin and Random House. Or you can contact me.
So. And you have a new website, sacredinstructions.life. And Sherry, thank you so much for not just sharing about your book, but about the journey that we've had with Love and Revolution Radio, bringing many of these concepts forward, even in the process of writing the book, and letting the show be a place where these themes and ideas can come up and be explored, both by ourselves and with our guests, and in the hearts and minds of the listeners as we all go forth from this moment.
Well, thank you, my friend. It's an honor to be on this journey with you.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
I want to also thank Diane Patterson for our amazing and wonderful theme song, Love and Revolution. It's performed by her and Spirit Radio, and you can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd like to thank my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, for giving me this opportunity to talk about my new book and for sharing the airwaves with me. It's wonderful to be back on the air with you, Rivera. And I am looking forward to the conversations that we will be having going forward. If you enjoyed the show today and want to learn more about the work that we do, you can follow Rivera and I on our individual websites. And you can follow the show on the Love and Revolution Facebook page. Rivera's website can be found at www.riverasun.com. And my web address is www.sacredinstructions.life. If you'd like to contact us regarding the show, please go to the show link on Rivera's website. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes. And we look forward to joining you once again next week, where we will have Sharon Blackie on the phone, who is the author of two incredible books, If Women Rose Rooted and The Enchanted Life. You don't want to miss that discussion. So we will see you again next week.
What if you knew that your actions determine the outcome of everything? How would you play if your actions determine